got some trouble. Shall we? It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. Here to cause a little bit of trouble, stir things up, enlighten, enliven, engage, agitate, irritate, entertain, whatever I can pull off in 3 hours. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. Apparently working. 1-888-64-NANCY or 1-888-0-NANCY. The number to the program, or the old one still works too. We're covering all bases here. 866-991-9927. Still in order. Okay, today, let's see, President Obama made a surprise visit to Iraq, and he delighted troops and lifted spirits in the green zone. And North Carolina Tar Heels had a surprise visit to Detroit's green zone, apparently, last night, delivering a little shock and awe to the hometown Sparties, further depressing a really, really depressed region. The good news is that that Jay Leno will be in town. He's going to be in Detroit tonight to make more fun of us and those MSU Spartans. So we've got lots to talk about today on the program. I did not like the game last night. We're going to get into that just a little bit later. I did not like the outcome of the game. I didn't like the entirety of the game itself, given the awful performance of the Spartans. But I did like the commercials. I did like the GM commercials in particular. I like the Total Confidence commercials. I like the messaging about rallying the team and making a comeback. So the commercials were the best part of NCAA last night. And it gets better than that. There's even more exciting things on the horizon from the hometown Detroit, folks. So let's just jump right into it. Dr. Christopher Baroni-Bird is the Director of Advanced Technology Vehicle Concepts at General Motors. And they had a really, really big announcement today about a personal two-wheel electric vehicle. But we'll get to that in just a second. Let's thank Dr. Baroni-Bird for joining us. First of all, thanks for being here, Chris.
Oh, you're welcome, Nancy. Thanks for inviting me on.
Now, so did you watch the game?
You know, I didn't. I was busy preparing for today's announcement.
Big press conference. Big announcement. Okay, so before we jump into that, because this is pretty big news. I've heard Rush Limbaugh and others making fun of it all morning. But you've been in this advanced technology program for a long time, working on customizable, all-electric, zero-emission wonder vehicles. And, you know, we've had a conversation. I'm a home time from Detroit. It's a national show, but I'm from Detroit. And we, over the last couple of days, this whole question of the EV1 came out. And I'm getting so many conspiracy theory emails concerning that, the nature of the EV1. Before we move into this newest thing, do you care, Doctor, to opine or weigh in? I mean, I've tried to explain to people that, from my knowledge of, have you seen Who Killed the Electric Vehicle?
Yes.
Okay. So you know, everyone, I've said, listen, folks, I'm a Wolverine. I went to U of M, finance major. Mostly companies are driven by profit. These were leases to test this particular technology. It didn't work. Why they were destroyed, I don't know, but my guess is that it was a program that wasn't working. And that I do believe that they were behind the eight ball in terms of advanced vehicles for some time, not seeing the gas price writing on the wall. I do agree with that, but that I don't believe in conspiracy theories. How do you weigh in? Because I know I'm going to get inundated with this question.
Well, I think battery technology in the 1990s wasn't as far along as it is now. And, you know, making a battery-powered vehicle that met customers' expectations for range and performance and cost was probably too difficult a challenge in the 1990s. And it's still a very difficult challenge. Even if we today tried to make a 300-mile range battery-powered vehicle, it would still be a daunting challenge, and that's with lithium-ion technology, which is really state-of-the-art. So I don't want to minimize this. You saw the battery pack that is used in the Volt when we introduced it at the auto show in January. We talked about the battery.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the size of Rick Wagner and with his arms outstretched, and the amount of energy that battery contained is enough, is stored in 1 gallon of gasoline, you know, to go 40 miles. So 1 gallon of gasoline has the same amount of energy as that huge battery pack that we had on display at the auto show, which was the size of a quarterback.
Mm-hmm. With the EV1, I mean, apparently these people love the vehicles and they performed well. What was the difference between the technology of the EV1 and the Volt?
Well, the EV1 used lead acid battery technology. Lead acid is the batteries that are in everybody's car as a starter battery,
mm-hmm.
and it's cheap. It's well known. It's proven, but it's not very dense in terms of energy. So if you try to develop a vehicle that just uses batteries to propel it, as opposed to just the starter battery, lead acid doesn't have the energy, doesn't have the range that you need to go a long distance. And lithium ion is significantly more energy dense. It packs more energy in a given amount of space than lead acid. And that's why it's used in consumer electronics applications, why your cell phones don't use a small lead acid batteries. That's one of the reasons.
Okay. Hey, there you go. There you are. I understand sometimes technological compromise. So it's just essentially what you're saying there, Doctor, is that the technology was just too immature. It takes time. It takes power. And we are on a learning curve.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the basic technical explanation.
Yeah. Yes. All right. So now GM, because I've talked quite a bit about the Chevy Volt. I had your vehicle line director for the Chevy Volt on the program. It's the first fully functional electric vehicle. And we're excited as pie about that because that can go 40 miles without any gasoline at all whatsoever. It's all only on the battery technology, correct?
That's correct. Yes. It has an electric motor that powers the front wheels and it gets the electricity from a battery pack, a lithium-ion battery pack down the tunnel. And if you drive more than 40 miles, which, you know, on average most people don't, but if you drive more than 40 miles in one day, you can use the range extender or the generator set. It's a gasoline engine generator set, kicks in and can provide you with hundreds more miles of driving if you need to. So it basically takes away the range anxiety that a lot of battery-powered vehicles have.
And that should be out sometime, next Thanksgiving is projected?
Yeah, the end of next year.
Okay. All righty. So we've gone through that. There's hybrids, there's electric, the Volt, everything's good. But today was a big announcement. Today was a surprise announcement, something we haven't heard about. GM introduced a partnership today that they've been working with the personal transporter Segway to unveil a two-seat electric vehicle targeted to the city streets. Now, this is called Project Puma for personal urban mobility and accessibility. Tell us, yes. Doctor, what is this? Is it like a Segway with a body around it?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. One is that you could take a vehicle and cut it in half and get rid of the rear wheels and basically have two seats sitting on two wheels. The other approach is you could take a PT and lengthen it, or widen it, I should say, and put two seats on top of it and make it enclosed. So we came at it slightly differently than Segway, but we came to the same solution. They're basically growing a Segway and we're shrinking a car. But I really want to emphasize that what we're talking about here with this project is really around mobility as such. We see a lot of challenges in traffic in big cities around the world where the traffic is going at maybe speeds of 5 or 10 miles an hour. And really the fundamental problem is mobility. And even if people had zero emissions vehicles that could run on renewable energy, if they were stuck in traffic or couldn't find parking, they would choose not to buy a vehicle. They would choose not to buy a vehicle. And a lot of people in New York, where we are at the moment for the announcement, can afford a car, but they just don't think it's practical. So it's not just sufficient to solve energy and environmental issues with electric drive. We've got to think about mobility.
Mm-hmm. Especially, I mean, I can see, obviously, in East Bay cities like New York, but I can even, I look at Sao Paulo, Brazil. I look at Mexico City. I look at cities, you know, across the world with more dense populations and lower consumption. I mean, lower ability to buy. So this is a way for them to get around and to have them buy vehicles, because they cannot have the same transportation infrastructure that we can, period. It will never happen.
Well, at a personal level, a lot of people can't afford a car, and at a societal level, if everybody has a car in these big cities, there's just not enough space for parking, and you have gridlock, and people can't get from one side of town to another in a reliable amount of time, and they're using a lot of energy being stuck in traffic. It's just not a sensible solution. When you have a vehicle that's designed to go 300 miles and can go over 100 miles an hour, and it takes up over 100 square feet when it's parked, and you know, it can carry 6 or 7 people and weighs 3 or 4,000 pounds. You've got a solution that's really like a Swiss Army knife. It can do everything, but it's really not designed for a dense urban environment where more and more of the world's people are living. So as we look to the future and we try to think about our business and how can we grow, we're hoping that a lot of growth will take place in emerging markets like China and India, but where the people live in those cities who can afford a vehicle is in the really big cities like Shanghai or Mumbai. and you see huge population densities there, and traffic congestion is already a problem. It's just going to get worse, and parking is an issue. So we think we need to rethink personal mobility. We don't want the solution in the future to be a choice between riding a bicycle or taking the train, or being stuck in traffic in a car. We think there's another approach that could make the most sense, a vehicle that's really small, nimble, easy to park, easy to maneuver, very energy efficient, very safe, and very clean and cheap.
I'm up against my break here, Doctor. If you have the ability to stay with me, I want to hear just a little bit more about this, and then I also want to ask you the big question. I know that people are going to say, well, you're trying to force all of us into these cars. I know that's a question. I'm going to let you answer it. I know what the answer is, but we're going to share that, Doctor, and get some calls in here if you have questions about this new announcement today. It's pretty exciting stuff. Dr. Christopher Barini-Bird is the Director of Advanced Technology. Advanced Technology Vehicle Concepts at General Motors. Today, the announcement of the Puma, the two-wheeler future for cities. 1-888-64-TROUBLE, right, John? 1-888-64-NANCY? 64-NANCY is the new number, the new 800 number. See, there's always advancement. And more to come on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Why doesn't Detroit just focus on making cars that people want?
Well, because Americans don't know what they want, John. I mean, you wanted bigger cars, Detroit gave you bigger cars. You wanted more fuel-efficient cars, Detroit gave you bigger cars. Make up your mind. When did Americans stop wanting cars that can be spun in giant centrifuges or jump through exploding barns? John, if Detroit fails, how will we stop our runaway cargo planes?
That's all very impressive, John, but how do those cars drive?
Not the best, John. For that, I think you'd want to look into a machine called a Honda.
Very funny, John Stewart, making fun of Detroit. Like, we need any more fun being made of us after that loss last night in the auto industry. Okay, listen, Detroit's making a comeback, darn it. This is the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program, or 1-0-NANCY. I am with Dr. Christopher Barini-Bird.
Hello.
Hi, Doctor. So, here you heard that little clip about Detroit always making advanced vehicles, or a big lump in vehicles. Today, you announced something very different. And before I get to it in a second, this is pretty interesting. I'm reading your bio. You came from Chrysler in 2000 as the Director of Design and Technology Fusion and asked yourself a simple question. What would we do if we could design a vehicle around fuel cell technology that would change how people need those vehicles, how we move? So, was this your, this to me sounds like a brainchild of, hey, look at, we got all these big congested cities. Even if we got a fully electric vehicle, like you said, we could all just be stuck in traffic with our perfect fuel cell technology vehicles, correct?
Yes. Okay. If you don't fundamentally change the size of the vehicle and how they operate on the system, on the roads together to avoid hitting each other and to avoid congestion, you're really not optimizing the complete system. You can have a very efficient vehicle, but if it's stuck in traffic, it's still getting 0 miles per gallon. Likewise, you could take old clunkers that get very poor fuel economy, and if you could smooth the traffic flow so that they're moving, you could improve their fuel economy. So we have to think, when we think about addressing CO2 and energy independence, I don't think it's sufficient just to think about making a fundamentally cleaner product. We have to think about how they operate on the roads together as a system.
So these go 35 miles per hour? They do go fast. I mean, well, relatively on a city road.
Yeah. If you look at the statistics, the average driving speed in most big cities around the world is probably 15, 20 miles per hour. And that's an average. And I think what we're saying is that instead of having a vehicle that's capable of going 100 or even more miles per hour, which needs a really big engine and a lot of fuel, you could come up with a much more practical solution just for an urban environment.
And is this just a concept, or is this something that's closer to production or reality sometime in our lifetimes?
Yes. what we showed today was really a concept, and I don't want people to misjudge it and say that, you know, it doesn't look very beautiful or anything. It's not completely closed off from the weather, because it is just a proof of concept. But we're developing next generation as we speak, and we will allow people to come back and drive these vehicles later in the year. But I think the important thing to point out, there's no technology that needs to be invented here. The battery pack on this vehicle would probably be about one-fourth the size of the one needed for the Volt, just because it's about one-fourth as heavy as the Volt and goes roughly the same distance.
A new product. We just have 1 minute left here, Doctor. What you've got is a new product on the drawing board. More reason to say to Detroit, we've got so much stuff in the pipeline, people. Just give it time, and you will see from whether you want the biggest fuel cell vehicle you can drive or you want something like this, a Puma that is mobile in a city. It's all
That's
coming
right.
your way, right?
Exactly.
Courtesy
We're working on both
of
extremes.
Courtesy of Detroit.
Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you, Doctor. We appreciate you sharing that. That's very exciting. I want people to know that we have tricks up our sleeve, man. Hang in there. Talk to Christopher Barini-Bird. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to talk about this because I already heard Rush Limbaugh all over it today. This is what they're going to do to you. They're going to put you in a two-seater. Leave them 5 minutes. Those whack jobs. I can hear them now. We'll be talking about that next on the Nancy Skinner Show.
The way to do it. How does Detroit go about recapturing that love?
Well, that's your first problem right there. I mean, what city is possibly the last place on earth you go to rekindle a love affair?
I guess Detroit.
Yes, exactly. Detroit. It'd be like having your anniversary dinner at a restaurant called Red Scabster. It's never going to work. It's never going to work.
That's not a real restaurant, is it?
Yes, John. It's a real restaurant featuring the cuisine of Detroit. I lost millions.
All right. What are you proposing, John?
Well, simple. Move Detroit to Cancun and rename it Cancun. Not only very romantic, but I hear the labor is much cheaper there. Next, eliminate all public transportation.
What?
Well, the industry is ready to commit to this relationship, John, but not until fickle Americans stop catting around with Amtrak and light rail.
But what about the companies that make trains and buses?
Oh, well, those companies will need a bailout, John. Delivered $1 at a time in 25 billion brand new PT Cruisers. Unfortunately, the only color available is electric blue.
Move Detroit to Cancun. I'm for it, actually. That might not be so bad. Oh, my goodness. How much scapegoating can one city take in 2 days? It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY or 10-NANCY or 1. Is anyone, the new number working? John, you're making me nervous about the new number. We've had our difficulties. 1-866-991-9927. No, really, I'm going to move into this a little bit, but I'll tell you what. Did anyone see the game last night? I mean, I watched quite a bit of the coverage, NCAA. John was actually at that game last night. Boy, was that painful or what? Go ahead, John. You can talk on the air. You're allowed.
You really want me to talk about that game?
Yeah, well, that was just from the gate, from the get-go. Here, the president and I were at odds. He was he had predicted North Carolina, right, from the beginning. I thought he was with Louisville, but brackets.
He picked the Tar Heels, and since we do have affiliates in the North Carolina area, I will offer my congratulations begrudgingly.
Well, okay, yes, congratulations on winning the national championship. Hey, I'm a Wolverine, man. I can't wait. Jay Leno's going to be here tonight. Now, Jay Leno has made Detroit a kicking bag, whatever you want to call it. What are we? We are the dirt bag for Jay Leno for a long time on his show. So he's come all the way. He's coming all the way from Los Angeles. Oh, there's a nice place with vehicle congestion. To Detroit tonight, where he's going to give 2 live comedy performances tonight and tomorrow. He's going to have lots of material with the crushing, bruising loss. If you're not a sports fan, bear with me, okay, on this, because I gotta just share this a little bit. The idea was, the Michigan State Spartans, this basketball team, beat three number one seeds to get to the national championship. Okay, the top seeded teams. And sort of defied the odds with everybody saying our unemployment rate in Michigan's over 12%. Everybody nationally talks about how bad it is. I saw some of the coverage yesterday of the tournament. ESPN and those folks came here. And what did they do? Everybody went and pulled out their cameras and went to the worst neighborhood somewhere out on the outskirts of downtown Detroit, which is a lovely and vibrant and revitalized sort of community, Ford Field. If you saw Ford Field, did you get to see it on TV at all? Gorgeous stadium, surrounding area, everything there. But no, they took their cameras and they went out to shut down factories, which we have. Because it was a manufacturing town, and they chose to show those. So there was so much kind of hope being placed on these players from Michigan State that somehow that they could eke out an upset and redeem the state in a way that was probably, I'm sure, was way too unrealistic for these players to do. Because, I mean, who could redeem the state at this point? And so they got clobbered right out of the gate. I mean, it was under 20. If you weren't watching the game, it was somewhere under 20 points the whole game. I forget what the final total was. It was awful. I kept thinking they were going to make a comeback, though. I kept hoping that they would get, like, within 12 points or maybe 10 points or something. And they did. And here's the thing. I'm a big sports fan. I know this is weird. I'm a sports fan. I'm a car girl. I'm a progressive. I'm an environmentalist. I am beyond description. I assure you of that. And you just think, well, it's all about momentum. And I'm going to get into this concept of momentum here in a little bit as well, based on the economy and some news I have, some new reports on the economy and momentum and confidence. So I really believe in that. So I thought that they would have like a couple of, good shots, some three-pointers, a couple of layups. They stole the ball. They had so many turnovers, though. It's almost like the analogy for what they did to what Detroit has done with an enormous amount of early game turnovers, which Detroit did a couple of decades ago and could never regain their momentum. I mean, I'm always thinking in big analogies and metaphors, and that's what it was like. But I just was hoping and praying that my rivals, my home state rivals, would have pulled out a victory with that much support behind them. I mean, that whole stadium was green and white. In any case, it didn't happen, and they lost, and it's hurting. Now Jay Leno's going to come tonight and make fun of us. And here's the thing. I knew this morning when I saw this announcement about this this new Segway and GM personal vehicle, this electric two-seater vehicle, I said to myself, oh, my God, Rush Limbaugh's going to be all over this. This is what they're going to do. This is their plan? This is the big, see, it's to take people out of their safe vehicles and just shove them into these. And what did he say on the way to work? My little honey bunny must have gotten my notes on this guest and was all over it, saying this is exactly what they're going to do. So you can't win for losing here. You know, they to the EV1 conspiracy theories, now they come up with a two-seat electric vehicle, and now people are mad at that. Put us in Cancun. Michael is in Newport, California. Hi, Michael. Thanks for hanging on through my tortured lecture.
Hi, Nancy. I'm afraid I'm going to have to contribute to some conspiracy talk here.
Oh,
well, maybe not conspiracy, but I'm really wondering about if people are being bamboozled about the whole battery problem, because back in the 1990s, we had the EV1. It had a range of 160 miles. And there were people coming out with batteries at that time that said they could get it up to 300. Now we're talking about 40 as if it's an achievement, and there's something really wrong going on here.
No, Michael, did you hear what he said? That was a lead. Did you hear my guest, who was the head of advanced vehicle technology for both Chrysler and GM?
I heard some of it.
He said it was a lead acid battery, which is that is the battery that's used in a standard car that doesn't have the same properties of an advanced long range vehicle.
Well, no, it was nickel metal hydride.
That was a nickel. Well, it was actually two iterations. And I don't want to spend every day going all over this, but it had, the first was lead acid. Then they went to nickel metal hydride, mm-hmm. which didn't perform well in Arizona and places where there was hot weather. And they just didn't have the ability to have it propelled in the way that we're talking about the Chevy Volt. However, the idea that they're not investing these billions in the Volt and all this new technology because somehow they're spending that money, but they really want to undermine it so that they do go bankrupt, to me, is insane. They don't. That car was a car that had, they were testing it out. It didn't perform the way they wanted it to on a mass production scale. And however it ended, it ended. But they are now spending billions of dollars. They're building battery plants here in Michigan and other places in the United States and trying to push the technology envelope as far as they possibly can. You don't honestly believe that the whole entire government and the whole auto industry, now that they've woken up from their stupor, really just wants to kill the car because they had it invented and they want to go back and kill it. Do you?
I think they hate change, to be honest. I think they're being dragged kicking and screaming into the future, and they're going to do everything to say we told you so, and we're not at fault here, and the government doesn't know what it's doing.
Yeah. So all these people that work here that you know I know, all these young people that are my age that are now engineers and graduated from the best universities in the world, they're all going to get sucked into that whole thing from 1996, and they're all going to work against their own company interests, and they're all, like this guy who. This doctor who, Dr. Christopher Barini Bird, who's looking at all these customizable, all electronic, zero emission vehicles of the future, all of this is just a big sham, Michael.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound snippy here, but if you can get in contact with maybe Alan Kankuni or some of the people who worked on the EV1. And ask them where things are coming from instead of the secondhand stuff. It might be illuminating.
How about Elon Musk? Okay, who's now you think he? This is a guy. Why didn't he just go ahead and use the lead acid battery of the EV1? If it was such a great car, this is Elon Musk. He invented PayPal. Okay, so he's a really young entrepreneur, and he took his billions and SpaceX.com to launch a first commercial private satellite into space. So did he go with that old technology from 20 years ago, or no? Well, did he push the envelope forward? Which he did. It's a tiny little laptop battery. I believe it is also lithium ion, but it's the kind that powers your laptops, and you have 6,000 of them strung together. And the problem there is that they haven't been able to mass produce them. Everybody is moving forward in search of better technology, and that technology will come, Michael. But the idea that honestly, I am just the conspiracy theory that somehow all of these bright engineers, all of these people are spending billions of dollars on the brink of solvency, and it's all just so that they can say we told you so and go bankrupt is absurd to me. Absurd beyond even me spending any more time on it, Michael. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you really think that all three car companies, that they don't even want a competitive advantage, you know, don't you think all companies, one company would, they're all in cahoots, all three of them are in cahoots, so that they can all say we told you so, and nobody wants change, and all these bright engineers from the University of Michigan, which is one of the finest high-tech schools in Michigan State and Tech Town, and people that flock from Europe and all over to the Technology Center of Detroit are doing that so they could get here and say, no, we're all going to hide our technology from you so that you think we were right. It's like Michael, insane.
You remember? Hello?
Yes.
Oh, do you remember how the three major automakers ganged up on Tucker when he made his improvements on the car during the 50s? They eventually, 20 years later, wound up adopting almost all his technology.
The 50s. This is 2009. Dude, you had people that grew up as environmentalists, engineers that are now running this company, these brilliant guys that have no vested interests in the past or in not changing, only in a brighter future because they have children, too. You know, we have kids, too, here in Detroit. We have a future, too, here in Detroit. We want to see a cleaner environment. We don't want to go to war for oil. We don't have – our profits have dissipated because of the lack of the foresight of the people before them in these companies. To say that this generation would sort of propagate some massive conspiracy to hold back progress is insane. Insane. I can't even tell you. All right. On that note, leave me alone about the EV1, okay? Please. And we're going to move on. I need the next story. I desperately need this. It's a neuroscience discovery. I know. I read these magazines. Okay? I know. It's all a conspiracy. 1-888-64-NANCY. The number to the program.
Come a long way, baby. You know I hope and I pray that you believe me. When I say this love will never fade.
So now I wanted to get this. Brain researchers are opening the door to editing memory. The scientists think they've identified how to tinker with a single substance in your brain to make you forget a chronic fear, a traumatic loss, or even a bad habit. And I wanted to get into that, but I think we need that sooner rather than later so people forget about the EV1 and think about the future because it's traumatized a whole generation of people in that experience. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. 1-888-64-NANCY is the number to the show. I'm going to get your calls in here, and then we're going to move on, President. Lots of things going on. Chris is in Orange County. Hi, Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Nancy.
Thanks for calling in. What's up?
Thank you. Well, you know, I don't think the loss of EV1 was really a conspiracy, as people like to put it. I think it's basically just about money.
Yeah.
Electric motors don't have a problem with needing a lot of maintenance, whereas a gas-powered engine or diesel engine does. And that maintenance money, if we've all taken our cars to the repair shop, knows that's a lot of money. And I think they all realized, and I know Toyota had an electric vehicle also, and they cut the production of theirs, and I think they all realized in the long run they would have a product that would maybe last longer than they'd really want it to. And if you have something you have to maintain all the time, there's a lot of cash in that.
Yeah, but it's all different interests. You know, the manufacturers don't have the interest of those servicers. That would be the dealers and servicers' interests. You know, and some people say computers are made for obsolescence. So, you know, again, I think if they are all investing in the technology, Chris, and they are trying to find the perfect vehicle that is zero emissions, that has the range, that has the batteries to get all those things in the, even fuel cells, to get the size of it to fit in a vehicle is another challenge. And I'm not saying give up on it. I'm saying put more in it. Look at the warp speed that we see, computer technology happening in. I mean, this has just not been a priority, and it has become one, let's put it that way, in recent years. So this news coming up on my screen, GM in intense bankruptcy preparation, news is not good. That they have a plan to split the corporation into a new company made up of the most successful units and an old one of its less profitable units. And that's gaining momentum as the most sensible configuration, according to an insider. That's not good. So GM's stock fell 14% on that. It's gonna be devastating. Let's put it that way. Gary is in Maryland. Hi, Gary.
Howdy. I just wanted to point out that during the Bush administration, there was this bill that that was passed. It was basically the energy bill, which said that the auto companies are going to invest their research dollars in hydrogen. Well, that's fine if they do that, but see, they overinvested in that and kind of got derailed when they finally realized, like a lot of people realized in advance, is that it wasn't really ready enough that they could actually make a good go of it right off the bat, you know. So it kind of took away the money that they could have used for investing in some other alternative fuel.
But you know, you can't. How can you, Gary, in Maryland, sit there and say that there's one technology? I think there's got to be development of fuel cells, of electric vehicles, of all kinds of different technologies, and the best one's going to emerge eventually.
Oh, I agree. But what I'm saying is that the energy bill during the Bush administration.
Oh yeah, because that was their dream.
It,
you know.
It said that this is it. This is the one. This is the one you're going to do.
Right. Exactly.
And gave the auto industry money to do that. But see, hydrogen just wasn't. You know, that much money wasn't going to do it. You know.
Well, especially with hydrogen fuel cells, because you have to have the entire infrastructure, which is doable. For like, I think it's $4 billion, you could retrofit 10% of all of the fueling stations to have a hydrogen filling pump. But it's a whole comprehensive plan. You've got to do this. And now I hear cap and trade is in big trouble. Politico is reporting that as well. So, don't be dissing this. All right, the president made a surprise visit to Iraq. Coming up next, we'll assess the outcome of that one. They're not going to like it. On the Nancy Skinner Program. Nancy Skinner. Okay, so far so good. President Obama makes a surprise visit to Iraq. No shoes have been thrown at him so far. So good. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY or 1-888-0-NANCY, depending on if you love me or hate me. And it doesn't seem to matter, Republican or Democrat. Get it from both sides. That's the way it is. Or you can email me at nancy@nancyskinnerlive.com. My email. Okay, surprise visit. As I said today, of course, it has to be a surprise, given security concerns. The president was greeted by elated troops, I should say, cheering going on. I thought this was interesting. Somebody shouted out of the crowd, "I love you. I love you back." The commander-in-chief replied, wearing a business suit, not in fatigues or leather bomber made for TV commercials about his commander-in-chiefness, just about his let's calm the whole world downness, let's talk amongst ourselves-ness like demeanor. Instead of going to the Green Zone, the president had the Prime Minister Nouriel al-Maliki come meet his motorcade. They had some issues with visibility, and they didn't want to put him on a helicopter. But again, the troops were thrilled at the announcement of his plans over 19 months to bring the troops home from Iraq. He said that it's time for Iraq to take responsibility for their country. And that was greeted by great applause by the troops themselves. So, you know, obviously military policy is on the agenda. Robert Gates, the defense secretary yesterday, we have some sound on that, laid out a whole new strategy for the approach to our weapon systems and moving from outdated weapon systems to kind of the things that we're going to need in the new irregular type of combat situation that we find ourselves in, not in old world big superpowers battling each other up World War II style. Is that we're going to get into that a little bit as well, or as well as a wake-up call with North Korea. That 3 a.m. call happened. It was really 4:30 a.m. call with North Korea firing off their Taipong missile. That's called it's reported to be a semi-dud missile because it didn't really go where it was supposed to be. But it's enough of a controversy in terms of the world community and how they're going to react to that forcefully or not so much, that we want to talk about as well. So joining me to do that is Van Hipp, who is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army and Deputy General Counsel of the Navy American Defense International. Thank you so much, Mr. Hipp, for joining me.
Yeah, it's good. It's great to be with you.
I covered a few grounds there. First of all, the President's surprise trip. Were you surprised if he was in Turkey that he ended up in Baghdad or no?
Well, it makes a lot of sense, and I'm surprised that the media didn't find out about it sooner. It makes sense when you're that close.
Yeah, it's a short Air Force One trip over there. Were you surprised that his reception was so good by the troops? Because there's been this perception out there that he might not have the same rah-rah testosterone factor that President Bush had. Seems like that wasn't the case.
Well, you know, the troops are always going to be happy, and whenever they see their commander-in-chief and they get a chance to be up close with their commander-in-chief, even if they didn't support that person in election. That's one thing about the American soldiers. They fall in line, they do their duty, and they support their commander-in-chief. So I think it's going to, you know, no question that McCain probably got more of the votes, but they're going to fall in and support the commander-in-chief and hope that he does well.
As is always the case with the military. Okay, so North Korea launches this Taipung missile or whatnot, three-stage missile that doesn't go three stages. And it's kind of the same old routine, isn't it, with the world community? You don't have enough to work through the UN Security Council, given the allies of their allegiances with China and Iran not wanting forceful action. The Europeans speaking with one voice against it. But, you know, it seems like it's a different world. Same old game being played with North Korea, but different world.
Yeah, it really is. I got to tell you, this to me is the most dangerous thing out there, and I've said this for years, that North Korea is a far greater threat to the United States than Iran. Let me tell you why. And the Federation of American Scientists have looked at this back to the 1980s. Iran has financed a great deal of North Korea's missile development activities. And if you take a look, Nancy, at this Taipodong missile and compare it to the Shahab missile that Ahmadinejad has right now, it's the same missile. They've been sharing. What concerns me, though, and this is what we got to watch out for, that Taipodong, he's been trying to lessen its weight, extend its range, this time under the guise of a satellite test, but it was a Taipodong missile that satellite was fired off of. They've got 8 nuclear warheads. And intelligence thus far is that they've not been able to put a nuclear warhead on that Taipodong missile. That's what we've got to watch for. That's the big threat to the United States.
Are we sure, Van, that they have, what you said, they have 8 nuclear warheads? What's the intelligence on that? It seems to me that we didn't have that specific knowledge.
I would say in the last year or two, it's come up from various reports, CIA types, and all. It's been out there that they have 8, but they haven't been able to, I think the terms I've seen, miniaturize them enough to fit on those warheads.
Because we cut a deal, just for background for folks, we cut a deal to stop the enrichment of plutonium or uranium, and then they switched to the other one. They sort of sideswiped it during the Clinton administration, which was, if you will, indulge me, sir.
I think it was the plutonium.
Okay, so then, they did a deal to stop plutonium, but then we realized that there were, had centrifuges and they were trying to enrich uranium. Right. And that is the situation with Iran. They are enriching, they have something like 6,000 centrifuges in Iran trying to enrich uranium that they claim for peaceful purposes, but obviously, there's the fine line, right?
Absolutely, and here's the other thing, and there have been a number of reports that 8 Iranian officials were on hand on Saturday in North Korea to observe the Taipodong missile launch. and it makes sense. They have been helping to finance their missile development efforts. I've always believed that the North Koreans had the missile technology. The Iranians probably were a little further along with the nuclear technology. You get them together, that's the dangerous link. And so, and both of these guys, Ahmadinejad, Kim Jong-il, you're dealing with some serious mental health issues with both of these guys.
Yeah.
And whenever you see one of them do something crazy, you wait 2 or 3 weeks and you can rest assured the other one will pull some kind of a, you know, stunt.
Right. Has there been any real intelligence on that connection there between, because North Korea is so, I mean, insular, not that Iran, not that they're the globe-trotting diplomats of some of the European nations, but what is there hardcore evidence that there's Kim Jong-il and Ahmadinejad or like got a tin can and a phone working, or?
Well, yeah, I'm going to tell you who really has come up with the intel on that. It's the Federation of American Scientists. They have looked at this hard, and they have gone back tracing money payments, oil payments from Iran back to the 1980s to Kim Jong-il's folks to help finance these missile development efforts. So the case that the Federation of American Scientists make is pretty darn convincing, and that's where I've seen the most credible evidence coming from.
And what about the financial situation? This is what amazes me. We're in a global economic meltdown. Neither, certainly North Korea is on the brink, and has been. These people are starving, this dictator. But Iran has suffered a great financial loss as a result of the drop in the price of oil as well. And they have, you know, they have a lack of refined oil products coming in, gasoline. They have a very large unemployed population. Where the heck are they getting this money to continue to fund this advanced enrichment of uranium?
That's a good question. Particularly the last few years, you think we've had economic problems. They've had something like 80-90% inflation. I mean, just unbelievable there. And so that's another reason why I think Ahmadinejad pulls these stunts to get the people's attention off their domestic woes and to try to inspire some kind of nationalistic type pride there. So I was speaking with a friend of mine in Europe just a few hours ago, and the feeling there is on Kim Jong-il, all of this is a stunt because he needs food. It's a blackmail stunt to the United Nations and the international community to have a bargaining chip so he can get food for his people.
Mm-hmm. And so then what do we do about it?
Well, I mean, let's see what the U.N. does. I'm not holding out any hope at all there because of the both China and Russia's veto capability on the U.N. Security Council. But this is something that I do think, and we've got to get our intelligence right there. I do think at the right time, Nancy, if we know he does have these nuclear warheads and he can accommodate that type of talk and they get it to work, we can't wait till that day comes. We've got to be prepared.
Right. So, you know, I'm up against a break here, but here's my dilemma. They're on the border of South Korea. How many troops do we have in the line of fire? How many is that? 40,000?
40,000.
So we have that as the option versus a weakened leader who's basically trying to get food for his people. Do you have the ability to come back, Mr. Hip?
Sure.
Okay, Van Hip is with us because I want to ask you about that, and then I also want to get that question in about the announcement by the Secretary Gates concerning a new budget for the military. Van Hip is with me. He was the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army. We're talking North Korea, Iran. We're talking about a drug to erase certain memories. Maybe we need to just dope these guys up so they'll forget they're so crazy. But we have to deal with them nonetheless because they are pursuing weapons of mass destruction of some kind or another in some coordinated fashion. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the Nancy Skinner Program. Right back in here. We've got a lot of big entrenched problems to figure out in the Nancy Skinner Show today. So let's do it. It is 1-888-64-NANCY. My guest is Van Hip, who was a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army. And we're talking about the North Korean missile launch and the dilemma that it poses for an international community that just held hands and sang kumbaya over the G20 and NATO summits about how we're going to enter into a new era of cooperation when Kim Jong-il fires this thing and again exploits the same old divisions that he has in the past. Van, here's my question, I think specifically. The whole threat of military action with 40,000 troops is just off the table, and everyone kind of knows that. So what about a new approach? What is the out-of-the-box approach completely to North Korea, and to, I guess you have to include Iran, with this renewed sense of cooperation among the world community because of the global depression and this new sense of, you know, we're all in this together. Is there something like here's an aid package and then something that looks like an international force, an expanded NATO force among, say, G20 nations? Or is anyone doing any creative thinking along those lines?
Well, you know, I think we tried that route with Kim Jong-il in the past, and that's when the deal was that he wouldn't be firing any more intercontinental ballistic missiles.
But we weren't allowed in the country. We didn't have an international peacekeeping force. Like I'm saying, tell them that here's your deal, and it's the mother of all deals, but what you're opening your country to, like a Kosovo-type situation where there's an international force, your people are now, you know, and somehow getting that before the people. I know they're so brainwashed there that it's hard to break through that mentality, but if you could open that country up to international communication, just like in Iran where you have these young people who are, you know, aren't happy with the mullahs, we can't seem to break that communications line?
You know, I would be all for getting international observers in there and getting people in there to do serious, real inspections to see what he's got and so forth. But don't forget, they're the ones who closed their borders because when they were open, people were fleeing out of that place. So I think the problem is going to be getting Kim Jong-il to agree to anything like that because he knows once it's open, people are going to want to leave. Now, I do tell you there are two outside-the-box things that I think need to be pursued right now. Number one, as far as North Korea is concerned, this is probably one of the very few times we could probably get Russia to help us. And the reason is, don't forget that one of the main reasons I think why he did or what he's saying, that he fired the Typhodon satellite on the top of it, was because he knew that the South Koreans were going to try to put a satellite in space in June. The Russians, believe it or not, are working with the South Koreans on their satellites. The Russians have a vested interest. It's your business with them, but they have a vested interest to see the South Koreans succeed on that, number one. Number two, I think the international community needs to put pressure on China. They get off scot-free. They've created 95% of this problem in North Korea. When you look at the Typhodon missile, a lot of that technology, I'd say the vast majority of it, is coming from China. They're the ones who've helped create this mental patient, Kim Jong-il, and his regime in North Korea. And I think the international and the Chinese are wanting to do business all over the world. I think the international community needs to hold China accountable and say,
on a lot more grounds than just the supply of technology to North Korea.
Oh yeah, bank accounts and everything else.
Yeah. So what's the reason for keeping 40,000 troops in South Korea? Is it simply the protection from North Korea? Because do we have a catch 22 scenario there? We can't do anything because the troops are there and the troops are there to protect them. Is there an outside of the box solution there? I mean, do we really need 40,000 troops in South Korea?
Well, I think we've looked at it not only from a South Korea standpoint, but also from a place if there was ever a situation. You want to have your troops in strategic or deployed areas, not necessarily too many, but enough to be able to respond if there's a major situation that you could respond adequately quick enough until other forces could come in. That's why we've kept forces in Germany, okay, after World War II. We've downsized there, but we still have a force there.
But aren't we, Van Hip, in a whole new, this is what I think Secretary Gates was saying yesterday.
Yep.
We're fighting irregular wars. We're sort of set up to fight these old world wars and with national alliances. And now it's more irregular and terror driven units. And so it's more high tech. It's more cyberspace. So 40,000 boots on the ground I don't know if that makes sense anymore.
I hear you. I'm all for that. But let me tell you this. Don't forget Anaconda in Afghanistan, where people think we lost Bin Laden. And that's where Rumsfeld and these all want to have all special forces, all air power, but get the grunt on the ground, and Bin Laden probably got away. And we took massive casualties there. And that's why I don't think we were successful at first in Iraq. We did it with too few. And I advocated having enough boots on the ground to do the job.
Right. With that amount of time, I really appreciate, sir, your time very much, Van Hip. We'll talk about it on the other side. 1-888-64-NANCY. Entrenched problems. We'll solve them on the Nancy Skinner Show.
My decisions have been almost exclusively influenced by factors other than simply finding a way to balance the books or fit under the top line, as is normally the case with most budget exercises. Instead, these recommendations are the product of a holistic assessment of capabilities, requirements, risks, and needs for the purpose of shifting this department in a different strategic direction. Let me be clear. I would have made virtually all of the decisions and recommendations announced today, regardless of the department's top-line budget number. The decisions have three principal objectives. First, to reaffirm our commitment to take care of the all-volunteer force, which in my view represents America's greatest strategic asset. Second, we must rebalance this department's programs in order to institutionalize and finance our capabilities to fight the wars we are in today, and the scenarios we are most likely to face in the years ahead, while at the same time providing a hedge against other risks and contingencies. Third, in order to do this, we must reform how and what we buy, meaning a fundamental overhaul of our approach to procurement, acquisition, and contracting.
A budget revolution, it's being called. That announced yesterday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, a major reshaping of the Pentagon's budget. And oh my goodness, is this going to set off alarm bells in Congress and in right-wing radio? I guarantee that much. It is a Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY, or 1-0-NANCY. Either way, or 1-866-991-9927 for safety's sake. All right, so here's the deal. It's interesting that first, before I leave the subject of a surprise visit to Iraq, that President Obama has been so well received, isn't it, by troops there? And he didn't. I know this is a subtle thing. Before I move into the military budget, he did not wear fatigues. I know stuff like that. Okay, why do you think that is? Why do you think that was like, I forgot my fatigues back at 1600? Or is there a message, a statement in that? The fact that he wore a business suit to meet the troops in Iraq and was warmly, a shout out. Someone said, I love you. And he said, I love you back. I do not remember that. I know that much was made of President Bush and his many visits to the troops in Iraq. They were surprise visits. I got an email here from Luther, who writes in, isn't it curious that all the visits by Bush and his officials to Iraq and now by Obama are all surprises? It proves that this invasion and occupation was and is a huge failure, because after all these years, they still have to sneak in by surprise for security reasons. It is for security reasons, and you are correct, sir. Now, this is what's interesting, and here's the tie-in. President Bush said to the troops, he's proceeding with his plans to remove troops, eventually by 2011, zero troops will be on the ground. Over 19 months, most of them, by next summer, most of them will be off for the ground. But said that they are choosing to do this because it's a political solution that Iraq and Afghanistan, he's changing sort of the mission there. It's not nation building anymore. It's more about political solutions to these problems. And they haven't been able to get their political act together. So we're not going to stay there while they do. I mean, that's essentially what he's saying. He said that they executed their job brilliantly there. The forces on the ground lost 4,266 UF troops have been lost their lives since the beginning of this war, and they haven't been able to get their political act together. So that he's moving forward with that plan, and that was met with huge applause. So isn't the same solution when we talk about the military budget? I was going over that yesterday. So you heard the opening that Secretary Gates wants to, one, increase troops. This is interesting. That it's a whole new world, if you just heard my interview with Van Hipp. Okay, increasingly, we're not going to be fighting these old conventional. It's not Risk. It's a board game, Risk. I was asking John through the break, I'm like, what was it? That geopolitical is like, who sank my battleship? Okay, we don't have wars like that anymore. We have insurgencies, and we need counterinsurgencies, and we have irregular armies, and we have all these different things going on that require a whole rethinking of these weapons. Now, this is going to be really, really difficult because of Congress and their lifeline to the monies that flow from these weapon systems. But essentially what Secretary Gates said is, one, we need more troops on the ground. So they're going to increase the size of the Army and the Marine Corps and reduce personnel in the Air Force and Navy. So that's going to cost an $11 billion increase to add more personnel, as well as an extra $2 billion for intelligence and surveillance equipment, including the Predator and Reaper drones, remote-controlled drones. Okay, so we're not sending people over there live to be shot down. In areas like Pakistan, Afghanistan, where you need those drones because you can't have people on the ground. I've talked to military folks who are really in the know, like intel people, who have talked about these regions, Waziristan, and where the tribal units that exist there are insane. I mean, these guys wear black like football players do under their eyes and carry swords. Crazy stuff going on. So mountainous regions, you just can't have big brigades, combat units going through there. So it requires a whole different type of approach. And here's the biggie. Then he's going to cut down on some weapon systems that are outdated. The F-22s, we're buying four more of those. That's been a colossal boondoggle. The F-22 in development for ever and so outrageously expensive. And it was designed, the F-22 in particular, this unit was designed to fight in the air with other Air Force airplanes. I mean, something we're not going to do. We're not going to have a major air combat World War II style system ever again. So why keep spending money on these programs, as well as, for instance, ships and shipbuilding? You are going to have Congress people, senators and congressmen. Senator Levin, we'll have to get him on the program to talk about this. He's taken a lead role as chairman of the Armed Services Committee, saying, you know what, this is the most entrenched system, and here's why it's so difficult. Because some of these weapon systems are nothing but big, huge earmarks. They are no longer necessary. They're outdated. They undergo cost overruns, enormous. Our military budget now it's going to end up being about $700 billion, I believe, when all is said and done. It went from $300 to $500 billion under the Bush administration alone, and it could end up. I don't know what the full numbers are going to be because a lot of jockeying and negotiations are going to go on. But it's not only the fact that the Congress people are addicted to these big weapon systems, the F-22s, cargo planes, ships, where we already have military dominance. We don't need any maritime programs. Who's going to beat us in that? But you have Congress people from states like Trent Lott and others that support the shipbuilding, and they're going to get in there and they are going to fight to the death of those dollars. And then you're going to have people like Rush Limbaugh, who today said this. I knew this was coming too. How do I know these things? Shocking. When I saw the Gates stuff, and I had to digest it a little bit to see exactly what they're proposing, you can read the speech yourself. He's saying that we need a, here you go. How's this for finding your Zen-like center? A holistic assessment. This is what they did, of their capabilities, requirements, risks, and needs for the purpose of shifting this department in a different, a strategic direction. He said, let me be clear, I would have made virtually all the same decisions and recommendations announced today, regardless of the department's top-line budget number. In other words, we don't just start with one number and figure out how to spend that. We figure out what our needs are, what the new battles are, the fact that we're not going to be fighting in these old preemptive attacks on countries. It's going to be more of this kind of counterinsurgency requirements. In any case, Rush Limbaugh, I need to say, what is the first thing a Democrat does when he gets into office? He cuts defense spending. And, there may or may not be a cut. I think it's actually going to be an increase, but it's certainly going to be a shift in the way that money is spent, more toward personnel, more toward veterans benefits. Listen to this.
So first, people. With regard to the troops and their families, I will recommend that we first fully protect and properly fund the growth of military and strengthen the base budget. This means completing the growth in the Army and the Marine Corps while halting reductions in the Air Force and Navy. Accomplishing this will require a nearly $11 billion increase above the FY09 budget level. Second, continue the steady growth in medical research and development by requesting $400 million more than last year. Third, recognize the critical and permanent nature of wounded, ill, and injured, traumatic brain injury, and psychological health programs. This means institutionalizing and properly funding these efforts in the base budget and increasing overall spending by $300 million. The department will spend over $47 billion in health care in FY10. And fourth, increase funding by $200 million for improvements in child care, spousal support, lodging, and education. Many of these programs have been funded in the past by supplementals. We must move away from ad hoc funding of long-term commitments. Thus, we have added money to each of these areas, and all will be permanently and properly carried in the base budget.
Hey, so here's my idea. Here's my big idea. When Rush Limbaugh says that President Obama and these Democrats, they're going to cut defense spending when we're actually increasing it on personnel, increasing Marine and Army numbers of troops and veterans benefits, and including those benefits in the permanent budget, we just respond with this. Why do you hate the troops? Why do you hate the troops and love the systems? Why do you love all the ships, but you hate the troops? Is that off base? Because he was all over. These guys are, I can't wait to see the right-wing radio and TV tonight. There, old President Obama, cutting defense spending, weakening our nation. When in fact, it's going to be a political solutions. That's what, from here on out, man, we're looking at big political solutions. And we're looking at big international peacekeeping forces, frankly, I'll just say it, to keep the peace once we've achieved those political solutions, like in North Korea. That's what's going to happen. Because everybody realizes that we're not going to have World War III along the lines of World War II with a nuclear armed world. Okay? That's just called as insane as Kim Jong-il. All right? Let's just call that like we see it. Political solutions backed up by peacekeeping forces. And slow reduction in our budget so that we're not dying, literally, economically, to go send our sons and daughters to die. Physically. Is that outrageous? A concept? All right. 866. No, 888. Why do I keep getting that wrong, John? 1-888-64-NANCY. Put a big sign right there on my forehead. I've just solved the whole thing. my goodness. Changing hearts and minds. That's what we're trying to do here on the Nancy Skinner Show. 1-888-64-NANCY. Just reviewing this. I wanted to get to this little thing. I don't know if we're going to today or not, but they put on hold temporarily. See, this is about changing minds. A Shiite law, that's the minority in Afghanistan, that's on hold after a review. A law that Karzai, actually President Hamid Karzai, signed into law, but now essentially because President Obama called it abhorrent, it's been put on hold by not being published. The law legalizes marital rape. So Karzai was under pressure to sign it because of the rape vote. I'm sorry, Marsha, I just cut you off. I was putting you up. Marsha, call back. I did it again. This law, he signed it under pressure from the minority Shiite, where they make about 15% of the population. And so I was thinking, what is this, the rape vote? And he had a crucial election, so he signed this thing? This is just outrageous. The law itself, Article 137, a copy of this law was obtained by Reuters, states, a wife is obliged to fulfill the sexual desires of her husband when she is healthy and has to wear makeup if her husband demands it. This is a law. I mean, this is how crazy the world is. Do you understand why education is so important? This article also says a woman cannot inherit any of her husband's wealth when he dies, a provision that already applies to Sunni Muslim women under Afghan law. Amendments made to the Shiite law show the marriage age for women was raised to 16 from 9, and that a woman would be allowed to leave her home unaccompanied for medical treatment, to go to work, or for her education. That's it. Those are the laws of the in Afghanistan on the books for the minority Shia that were only put on hold because of an international outcry from Western nations. Can you believe that? I mean, that is why this. I think the way to solve all of the world's problems is to get iPods and give everybody access to all communications all across the world and educate them to what's going on in the modern world. And we won't need weapon systems or troops. We just need iTunes and talk shows and education. We won't have rape laws that say you have to wear makeup and have sex with your husband if you're healthy enough. Oh, my. Marsha is back in Buffalo. Hi, Marsha.
Hi. How are you today?
This is funny, isn't it? I'm fine. Thank you for calling
in. It's crazy.
Crazy.
You know,
I
think they have a real, I don't know if I can say this on the air, Madonna whore complex over there.
Well, you know, but way long before Madonna, you think there's always time marches on and with that progress, but this is 2009 and they're passing these votes. Rape. You have to wear makeup while you're being raped.
Yeah.
my goodness. That seems like a lot of work.
Yes.
Anyways, you called in about troops in Europe.
Yes.
And I wanted to hear this.
60 years after the end of World War II and 20 years after the end of the Cold War, why do we need to have so many troops in Europe and even in Japan? I mean, I think we could save billions by taking them out.
I agree. I do. I think that it's old thinking. And as I had Van Hip on the show, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Republican, I believe, he agreed that it's, you know, there's a certain level of boots on the ground, but it's a changing world. And to have 40,000 troops in South Korea, and I think it's still 17,000 in Japan, for what reason, you know?
How many in Germany?
Oh, goodness, I don't even know the numbers. 30,000, I think, in the realm of 30,000 troops on the ground. If those folks were redeployed to areas in more of a peacekeeping fashion, in more tenuous areas, then you know, it would be a different story. But in Europe, in Japan, iPods. How about that? The iPod weapon system of the future. It's called education. Enlightenment, all through a little portable device. I'm for it. All right, we're going to move on and talk about, hey, Vermont, guess what? They have same-sex marriages. They overruled it. Wow. We're going to be talking about that. We talked about it yesterday, and Vermont caught on today. More to come on the Nancy Skinner Show. Then let's move this thing along. this is really amazing to me. I'm the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-Nancy or 1-ooh-Nancy. Whatever you feel like. Talk about the cultural divide here. So we just in the last hour just talking about this law in Afghanistan that's been put on hold now for the minorities, a Shiite law that essentially legalizes rape that requires a woman to have sex with her husband if she's healthy and wear makeup. Doesn't say anything about high heels in there. The law. Western outcry has now forced President Hamid Karzai, who signed it, to get in with the rape vote crowd, signed that law, said he will review it. Honest to God, it does. It honestly says a wife is obliged to fulfill the sexual desires of her husband when she is healthy and has to wear makeup if the husband demands it. She cannot inherit any of her husband's wealth when he dies as well. Okay. I did, as I continued reading this article, I did see this, though. It says that they've made some improvements, some advancement in recent years. They moved the age for marriage from 9 to 16. Now it says that in modern times, since they're getting a little more edumacated there, it says a woman can divorce her husband if he cannot provide for her, if he cannot satisfy her in bed. Whoa. Try and enforce that one, honey. Or if he is absent for a period of time. Okay. Like Monday Night Football. So, in any case, think of cultural divide from that to Vermont and the legislature now giving their final okay on gay marriage. This just 4 days after the Iowa Supreme Court ruled that this was a Supreme Court ruling upholding a lower court ruling in favor of gay marriage, saying it would be a denial of anyone's constitutional equal protection under the laws not to do so. But this is the first time Vermont is the first state in which the state legislature they actually overrode the veto of the governor. So it went through the state legislature as opposed to the other states where it's been, these have been court decisions. So now gay marriage is legal in 4 states of this union, Iowa, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont. You have the liberals' coastal states. It was in California for 5 months. And the heartland, Iowa. Even though Vermont is a tiny state, population 600,000, that's like my old congressional district. It's being hailed by activists and bemoaned by detractors. Let's see. You will start to see some national ads put out by the National Organization for Marriage. These are national ads that, Brian Brown, the executive director of this group, said it's a sad day for Vermont and for the nation, and his organization will be launching these ads soon that highlights how same-sex marriage undermines the core civil rights of those who believe in the simple truth that marriage is a union of one man and one woman. Those ads will begin tomorrow. So joining me to talk about this cultural divide and the seeming advance of You know what? It's not such a big deal. Not my problem. Okay, live and let live. That seems to be happening in our country. Is Bishop Harry Jackson Jr. He is chairman of the High Impact Leadership Coalition and a senior pastor of Hope Christian Church. And he's in Washington, D.C., and he's a wonderful guy, conservative, and he and I probably don't agree on a whole lot of things, but we're here to talk about them together. Hi, Bishop. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a privilege it is to be with you.
Before we move into the gay marriage thing, I know that was what my producers had talked to you about, talking to me about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you make of this law in Afghanistan, you know, the Shiite, that religious groups can kind of, you know, draw a parallel and say, hey, this is our religion, okay? We mm-hmm. believe that women should have to have sex with their husband with makeup on, and we're going to codify it in law. And couldn't you say the same thing, is that with marriage here, that we are taking a belief, a religious belief about the union of one man and one woman, and codifying it in law? Yes, there are extremes on the opposite ends, rape and marriage, but essentially you're codifying religious beliefs and treating people differently. They don't have the U.S. Constitution. We have a constitution. That's why this, you know, these rulings are taking place here.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't there an analogy to be made there, Bishop, between taking religious beliefs and saying these are the laws of the land?
Well, everybody's law has to have some moral foundation. And the question is, how far can religion by itself apply the law? It seems to me that what's out of order in the situation that you talked about is that you have a merger of faith and the government. In other words, the government is enforcing directly the law. It is a theocracy in the worst sense of the word. I think what we have here in America is a clear separation of church and state, in that the state enforces laws. I think it's fine for the church to inform, if you will, with their morality, the making of laws. And so the great thing about America is that people have choices. People can vote for same-sex marriage, for example, or they can vote against same-sex marriage. And the rule of the people, the will of the people, will become the rule of law. So I think that's a major difference. It is not the same thing in that way. And I think, though, that one of the things that we need to look at in America is simply what is going to be best for future generations. How are we going to live together? In my community, the African-American community, I'm an evangelical leader, and I connect up with all the white leaders as well. But as I look at the black community, I see 7 or 8 out of 10 babies born out of wedlock. 40% of my young women are going to remain single, won't ever get married. I've got out-of-control birth rates. I've got incredible HIV-AIDS problems with heterosexual young teenage females. So what I'm looking at is the destruction and maybe even the extinction of the black family as we know it, and I think the white and Hispanic families are falling behind it. So,
well, you just said so much there, Bishop. A couple of things.
Sure.
Let's go back to the difference, and then we'll move off of Afghanistan. The difference between the United States and Afghanistan is, you said, it's a popular, people can vote there how they believe, and they vote it into law, and that's the same as here. Well, they vote there, if somehow that vote survived, both parliaments was signed saying women have the right to be raped, or they can be raped. Here we have a constitution that says you can't vote that, you could never vote that in.
Right.
You know, we have equal protection of the laws, and it's what allowed interracial marriage, with civil rights laws,
mm-hmm.
and we have indeed the first black president of the United States. Okay, so because of that equal protection and the absolutely, so the protection of those laws. So, all right, so you agree that it is that equal protection clause that distinguishes our culture, our country, from some country like this, right? Afghanistan.
I would agree with that, but again, I would say that somebody's morality shapes the law, somebody's view, and what I find is a kind of emerging reverse prejudice against many religious groups, saying, okay, everybody gets to talk, but the church should shut up, and that's not exactly fair either. So all the people's opinions need to be taken into account. Thank God we're a little bit more advanced in terms of our view of women and our view of life than maybe Afghanistan, But I think when you're dealing with democracy and the vote of the public, you're going to have to journey according to the awareness of the people. And that's where things like teaching, preaching come in. That's where great campaigns could be run in Afghanistan by enlightened people who will say, hey, that's not right. Listen to another way.
I think there's no disagreement among us on that, that the role of religion to teach the golden rule, essentially, should be spread across the globe. I believe that, do unto others, and I think that it stems from every great, it doesn't matter which religious tradition you're talking about.
Right.
It's the same law there. But let's say, Bishop, that it's just about taking a snapshot in time, looking at popular views on an issue and then taking a vote. Interracial marriage would have never survived. I mean, people would have said, no, that should be restricted had it that been taken. And, well, there were laws on the books for interracial. Iowa was the first state to smack down interracial bans on marriage. Isn't it just always about the march of humans getting to know humans and being not so afraid of their differences?
Well, I think there's something more fundamental here. If I'm dealing strictly with same-sex marriage, I think a fundamental question is, does this promote or propagate the betterment of the culture? That's very debatable. Same-sex marriage. Does it denigrate or devalue an institution that is religious in its origin? It might be have been best in our...
You know what? I'm going to let you answer those questions on the other side of the break because you've just posed some really great questions. If you will stay with me,
sure.
I want to put that out there for people to... I want to hear your answer, Bishop, and then I would like to hear what other people have to say as well. Bishop Harry Jackson Jr. is chairman of the High Impact Leadership Coalition and a senior pastor of the Hope Christian Church, and he's posed some interesting questions about now we're not talking about equal protection of the law, now we're into the moral value about promoting the general welfare. Did you hear that? Promoting, propagating what's best for society. A different story altogether. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number of the program, or 1-888-64-NANCY. That's right. Same numbers. See? Just able to take in two different views all at once on the Nancy Skinner Show. Minds being changed when it comes to the issue of gay marriage rapidly now, with Vermont a day behind, well, 4 days behind, I should say, Iowa, and now 4 states legalizing gay marriage. Even Rick Warren, The Purpose Driven Life, was on Larry King Live last night, and was asked about gay marriage, whether he was changing his mind about it, and said it was very low on his priority list, which is a turnaround from his 2004 letter he sent to his Saddleback Church congregation saying it was one of the 5 non-negotiable issues. Now he's saying, well, not so much. Very, very low on that totem pole. My guest on the program, Bishop Jackson, I'm not gonna ask you. Well, first of all, what do you think about Rick Warren saying this? Do you think he has changed his mind, or are there just bigger fish to fry?
Bigger fish to fry. I think this is a battle that is going to go on for some time, and his clear priority, as is mine, is in the local arena. He wants to help people transform their lives, improve their marriages, and do things like take care of the poor. Fighting a legislative or legal battle is the purview of a very, how can I say it, specialized group of folks. So those who know Warren say he's going to fight HIV/AIDS worldwide and poverty.
Okay, so let's get some other viewpoints in here. Amy is in Attica, New York, upstate New York. Hi, and Amy, I understand you are a pastor's wife. So
yeah, that's true. I'm a member of the United Church of Christ, which has congregational roots. We're the church that that ordained the first black minister in the United States, the first female minister, the first gay minister. Everybody plays catch up with us. We were the ones who were on the side of Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez back when nobody else really cared. And I have to say, my marriage is not devalued in any way by the fact that gay folks can get married. And it very much upsets me when I hear clergy speaking this type of talk, because if it wasn't for churches like the Congregational Church, first of all, people still would jump in the broom.
Hey, Pastor,
three-fifths of a person.
What do you think about that, Pastor? She's making a good historical analogy to, you know, the race and the issue of isn't this the new racial?
It's about civil rights. It's about civil rights, really.
It's not civil rights. Nobody lynched you by the thousands for your stand. I think the hatred against blacks, it's inconscionable that you would even equate that one with another. It is not
also,
the level. You,
if you're
you
born black or if you're
you
born gay, what's the difference? God loves you no matter what. God loves everyone. If you're missing Jesus' message of love during Holy Week, Jesus' message of loving God, loving your neighbor as yourself,
yep.
If you're missing that during Holy Week...
No, I'm not missing it. He loves people, but he also has a way that he wants us to live. He's got an owner's manual that talks about how people should conduct themselves, not as an imprisonment, but he's willing to give grace, lift you, help you be able to walk in the way that he has ordained.
Well, Bishop, when you say the owner's manual, you're talking about the Bible, because if you're talking about the Old Testament, I'm sure, Amy, you can cite a lot of examples. You can stone women and stone your daughter, sell her off. You know, there are a lot of the Old Testament is rife.
No, it's just not just that. You can go to Romans and you can understand and educate yourself to the fact that the word homosexual was not even coined until the 1850s. You can understand.
Yeah, but it's
talked about
the
those matters. They were talking about cataracts.
In Corinthians chapter 6, you find them talking about effeminate people and various other things that deal with even male.
I'm not going to even, unfortunately, Bishop Harry Jackson, I am not going to have enough time to quote all the scripture that you're quoting. Obviously, you're coming from two completely different perspectives on this.
Yep.
You know, hey, I got you out here to share your point of view, and I appreciate you listening to Amy's, and I think the time marches on. So that's my view, is that time marches on, and the do unto others, I thank you for being with me, but I will wrap on this. Do unto others, the golden rule is the most prominent rule in the Bible. I don't care about the Old Testament, that's the New Testament. We'll continue with this conversation on the Nancy Skinner Show. But think, is this recession, is this depression changing hearts and minds about the culture wars, changing the culture divide wars? It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number that is working to the program. And the reason I ask that question is we're just coming off this discussion now. Vermont is the fourth state to have legalized gay marriage. That over a veto, the governor's veto, the legislature, first legislature to have passed that law. So it's not equal protection. The right to be miserable shall not be abridged by anyone anymore. It seems to be more like Rick Warren said on Larry King Live last night, just much lower on his priority list. He actually said, I pulled up the whole interview, that he's really concerned about one's Rwanda, something's been working on, but he also said the second thing is, I'm interested in what the recession is doing to the spiritual climate of our nation. And he's going on and on and on about how he believes that we need to come together, that there are 600,000 Buddhists in the world, 800,000 Hindus, a billion Muslims, and 2.3 billion Christians. You have to all get along. So Is it really that maybe our hearts and minds are being changed a little bit by this? And it's like, okay, so you know what? I am not affected by a gay couple that gets married. That's what my last guest, Bishop Harry Jackson, said. What does this do to society? I'm not gay, but it does nothing to me. It does not affect how I feel about men. How I feel about marriage is how I feel about marriage. It's a whole different story. It has nothing to do with two gay people who are choosing to be together and want to be together. That's their own problem. It is not mine. That's how I feel. God bless them if they're taking care of each other and taking care of other people. That's just my view. It's never been an issue for me on some emotional or spiritual level. It has not been anything that's ever threatened me or I've been concerned about. But some people are, and there'll be a national ad campaign that starts tomorrow saying that these votes in Vermont and Iowa are undermining your core civil liberties. That is the essence of this commercial. Your civil liberties, Randall and Buffalo, are being undermined. You might not even realize it. But they're going to tell you tomorrow, a national ad campaign will say that you just wait, buddy. You're losing your civil liberties.
That is so ridiculous. Those folks have nothing to do with me and my choices, as my choices have nothing to do with them. I think that minister, that guest that you had on, is holding resentment and judgment and arrogance to suggest that the people in his congregation that are getting divorced and catching AIDS and, you know, being single parents and young parents and on abandoning their kids have anything to do with homosexuals wanting to get married.
You know, I wanted to jump in, but I didn't. But that was the question. Like, so you think that it's gays that are causing this? That's the issue of the list of grievances that he cited there?
How misplaced is that anger? He needs to direct that toward his congregation. Say, step up, brother. Step up, sister.
Well, you know what I find, and you mean brother and sister in the sense of Christian, right? Because he is African American.
People in his congregation, you know, if there's a girl and a woman in his congregation who's having babies out of wedlock, and you know, et cetera, or a man that's abandoning his family, say, step up, brother. What are you doing?
Well, you know, and I think
anyone else. There's no other excuses.
President Obama, so that this doesn't get turned into a free love thing, has on so many occasions talked about the responsibility for families
right.
and for black men to step up to the plate and do what's right where those voids exist. But I do think you're right, Randall, in that there's hypocrisy, especially with an African-American pastor who suffered the legacy of it, you know, the hatred that exists, the ignorance, it's ignorance and fear of the unknown as it relates to race. Now you've got, and I wish I had more time, but also want to say, he said something about the disappearance of the black family. I will add this to the conversation, Randall. I am seeing with the president and his wife and their two beautiful daughters and the way they are received on the world stage, I am seeing a whole new pride out there, just in among African American family units. Are you noticing this, or is this just me? There's a sense of, look at how beautiful they're, glamorous, the rock stars on the planet. And I think that there is a reflection back, and I like the opinion of African Americans, and maybe this is just mine, at 1-888-64 Nancy.
You know, there's other arrogances too that came off there. You know, the people who practice fundamentalist Mormon, polygamy, they're coming from a religious angle. They say God sanctions this, so why would this, I would bet my paycheck this man looks down upon them and judges them as somehow sinful. That's, I mean, come on. Our constitutions, I say plural because of the states, are founded on moral principles. They are founded on people that are holy and righteous. Our constitutions,
well, you know? I think in the inherent principles do no harm. And I don't see how,
well,
I really have never seen how,
right.
you know, someone else is, two other people loving each other and saying they're gonna try and do it forever.
what you're overlooking is the inherent morality in the statement, there is equal protection under the law. That is the moral values of America, right there.
I see. So you're
just
saying
because it doesn't say do this or do that according to the Bible doesn't mean it isn't moral or based on a moral foundation. Equal protection under the law is the character and morals of our country.
And you know what, Randall? You know what? It is also what you've done brilliantly here is you've taken the what was codified in the legal terms, made it a moral principle, and I'm going to one up you, buddy. That is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. Right. We are all equal. That's where that principle comes from. God created everybody, and there is equality and reflection and divinity in every soul. So that's the point.
Absolutely. And I'm a minister here in Buffalo, and I minister to people who are outside of the physical building of a church, an organization of a church. They're people who want to live in the house of the Lord, whatever they define that to be, but that house, that temple resides in their heart, where their soul is. Not some building with some person saying, this is what you have to do to walk in this door. Hey, if you want to get married in a church, go ahead. If you want to get married by me and not have God involved, that's fine. If you want to go get married in a national park out in Allegheny, that's great. That's all God, man. That's all good.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I'm not.
The state doesn't care. The state just cares that you sign the piece of paper saying you're now married.
Well, yeah, and they get a fine, a fee, and you know what I think the state interest is in all of this is that the state's interest is that, you know, kids are taken care of because kids are brought into the world, and we do have a society, and there is a legitimate, there is an argument to be made.
Corporation, you're combining, you're merging different finances and estates. That's all they care about, property rights laws. That really is all it comes down to.
Well, that, you know, so the rest of us, we have to have a system whereby when you bring a child into this world, we're all a society, and that you better be taking care of this kid, and you're not, if you're not, you're going to be fined. But that's a different thing.
Absolutely.
Different construct.
And that's, you know, it has nothing to do with churches.
All right. Well, Randall, very well put. We have a lot of religious people listening to this program.
And congratulations on your new show. It's very nice to hear from you. Very good. Thank you,
Randall. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
That's good. See, you know, he did a great job right there of combining all of it, right? He went from the legal argument to the moral foundation to, I would say, that's what it is codified writ large, and going back to the whole situation internationally, even. Going back to the Afghanistan conversation, come on, in what warped society, even if you look at the principles, which I've studied all of them, the Bhagavad Gita, I've read all the different religious doctrines as much as I can, 12 years of Catholic school, Lord knows, under what religious principle can you say, could you ever devise the theory that it's okay to rape your wife and she has to wear makeup while you're doing it? It doesn't exist. The whole, we're all one. You are your neighbor's keeper, whether you like it or not. And I think that even when you see Rick Warren, this is, to me, progress. When Rick Warren remember the big kerfuffle because he was chosen to give the invocation at President Obama's protest, and I said, you know, this is exactly antithetical to the sentiment of let's just all move forward here, people. We have bigger fish to fry, okay? We have much bigger fish to fry. Robert in North Hollywood. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Nancy, I really like your show, and I used to like, Who's before you that, you know, is no longer here, but I like your show even better. I have to disagree with you about the gay issue, and I'm not coming from a religious standpoint, but here's my premise and see if you agree or not.
Okay.
Marriage is the oldest institution we have. The main reason for marriage, even though people don't think about it anymore, is to keep make people responsible. If you're married, you're less likely to go around and, you know, screw around with other people. You're going to keep a family unit together. You're going to be responsible. All qualities and the same things that the African-American minister that you had on the phone, that his biggest concern locally is that people are not taking responsibility. They're having unwed pregnancies. They're having so much sex that they have, all the diseases to contend with. If you change the definition of marriage, which has always been a man and woman, to two men or two women, then you do it on a civil rights basis because they love each other. The definition of marriage doesn't mean anything. And then what happens is an increase of what's going on right now that the minister and other people are seeing in certain communities, especially with the young people, because nobody's going to get married. Oh, marriage doesn't mean anything. Five people can get married, people will be saying. So the reason is I think there should be a national law, a civil right for everybody that wants to be, have a civil union. That is their right. It's my stupid GPS. But you don't change the definition of marriage.
Well, but Robert, okay, I'm hearing what you're saying. You're taking a step from nobody's changing the definition of marriage per se. Okay, that's a religious, and every religion has a right to choose what it is that they'll sanction. But you know, you're making this really big leap from a heterosexual one-on-one to legislating orgies.
That is not
the same thing. You're making this hypothetical leap that if we allow two people to make a commitment and have equal protection under the law, that's what you're neglecting. No one wants to change the definition of marriage that religious group organizations, the Catholic Church, whichever church, I would never change that. If the Catholic Church says no way, never, ever, ever, that's their right. They've been around a couple thousand years.
Marriage is a legal term. It is not a religious term. And the basis that pro-gay people, and I'm a pro-gay person, I just don't believe in changing the definition of marriage. Their basis is it's a civil right. If two people love each other, irrespective of the same sex, if two people love each other, they should be able to get married. If you change the definition so that is the case, then you will have three people that love each other, and their love is not any less important than two. Or you'll have four people.
But nobody's changing the definition of marriage. There is nowhere that says a marriage is between a man and a woman in
constitutional laws in these four states that you said changing the definition of marriage, Nancy. That's
every time a ban, this is Robert, what we've just gone through. Every time a law has been passed banning that, the courts look at the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and say, you can't do that. This is a civil right, and there is not anything that says marriage is a religious institution.
I have a marriage certificate from the state of Nevada. It says marriage certificate. Nevada is not a religious state. It did not pass a religious test for us to get married. But my certificate says marriage certificate.
Robert, I'm not going to hang up on you, but I'm up against my break here. If you want to hold on.
I love to hold on.
Okay,
I love talking with you.
Hold on. I don't like cutting people off, but I'm getting the angry John face because I'm late. 1-888-64-NANCY. We'll finish this on the other side. Pardon the pun with Robert. I'm going to finish out. Thoughts on changing the definition of marriage? Isn't everything changing? Isn't that life called change? Because it seems to be happening more quickly. There's some quantum physics thing going on, I'm telling you. Four states now allowing gay marriage. Vermont, this is like speeding up. It was just Iowa 4 days ago, now it's Vermont. And we're talking about... Maybe it's the recession. Maybe people are thinking these culture wars are not such a big deal on the Nancy Skinner Show. 1-888-64-NANCY. I was on the phone with Robert. Robert in North Hollywood, California, who says that we're changing the... Robert, you got to turn your radio down there, buddy. While you're doing that, he says... Hold on. We'll let Robert turn his radio down. Turn your radio down, Robert, so I don't hear myself. And while you're doing that, I will read you an email from Andy who writes in concerning you, Robert, about the definition of marriage. Andy writes in that he has it just backwards. It is the organizations that want to ban gay marriage that are literally trying to change the definition of marriage in the constitutions of their respective states. The courts are saying, no, you can't change the definition of marriage to exclude people because of their sexual orientation. And do you have your radio down now, Robert?
Yeah, it was off. It was just me talking then.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So you know, I think that's my point. Marriage, I would say this. Marriage has, you ask people what marriage is, go down the street, you're going to get a lot of different opinions, but it has a civil component and it has a religious component. The religious component, I don't think, you know, there's a First Amendment right to for churches to keep that however they want to keep that. The civil component, though, falls under the jurisdiction of a constitution. And it says you cannot exclude rights, you cannot give benefits and privileges of an institution to one American citizen over another. It doesn't say anything about numbers of people. It doesn't say that.
The civil, again, this is the third time, very quickly, the argument that the proponents of gay marriage make is civil right, and it's a civil right because two people love each other, they just have to be of the same sex. If that passes, you will have three people who sincerely do love each other, and then you change the definition again. So that's what happened. I'm for a constitutional amendment, but we can't even get one for equal rights, which we should have for men and women. We should have one for civil union. Anybody should be able to enter into a civil union and have all the responsibilities and all the rights.
Well, that's what essentially this is. It's a civil union. You're just saying that they get the same tax deductions. They get the same benefits, estate benefits. There's a lot of benefits that go with the word marriage that are civil.
It can't be called marriage for the same arguments that I've made. By the way, to KTLA out here in L.A., I'm really happy you're on the show. I don't miss Randy at all. I got mad because she was so disrespectful to many of the callers. You've never done that, Nancy. Well, you're a joy to hear, and I really, really hope you stay with us in L.A. for a long time.
Well, thank you, Robert. I try not to be disrespectful to anybody who's out there and who calls into the program or other hosts. I try and see if you get a common theme on my show. If you've learned a little bit about me by now, aw, that's nice, John. I do. I know. I'm hokey. I am. I really believe that we need a little bit more of that and respect, and that we can listen to other people's points of view. And it's not always about, I have to be right all the time. Who could possibly always be right? You'd be like Kim Jong-il, man. Totally off your rocker. We're not always right. We should be talking, listening to each other, and respecting each other, not bombing each other. That's what I think. Get a lot more accomplished. So that's my MO, and I'm sticking to it today and tomorrow. And I will be back tomorrow on KTLK in Los Angeles and across the country on the Nancy Skinner Show.